That tune was called Housewares Blues by Stefan Kartenberg, released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 Unported License, and can be found on ccmixter.org. Hey everyone, welcome to the Cavalcade Audio Hour. I'm Lost in Bronx, and this week we're listening to Street Candles, Chapter 25, and another episode of Voice from the Void. But time is crazy tight this time, so let's get rolling. Talk to you next week. Take care.
Cavalcade Audio Productions presents Star Drifter, the science fiction audiobook series written and read by David Collins Rivera. Book 2, Street Candles. Today's installment, Chapter 25.
I was over half a kilometer from Mather's factory home when I noticed that there were many more people on the streets than before. Some had heavy packs filled with camping or survival gear, some had ground cars and smaller vehicles, and one was even on a horse. I stood stock still and laughed as it trotted by with ringing clomps, for I'd never seen one in real life. It was huge and brown, and the cold-geared woman riding it bounced up and down with each step in a strange, comfortable fashion. As I rounded the corner, I came upon a checkpoint set up in the street. It was composed of a mix of civilian and military seculars standing behind a makeshift circle of road barriers in a four-way intersection. Two automated guns were also set up here, each one covering half the perimeter. Robots like these were often found around military and detention centers in the Alliance, and these two looked pretty advanced. Such machines were smart, extremely accurate, and if securely anchored, quite rugged. The simplicity of their appearance belied their lethality. Just oblong metal boxes on heavy gimbaled poles fitted into conical concrete bases. Sensors and sighting components, ammunition, control circuitry, power sources, and firearm systems were all integrated and protected behind solid polinium casing. Lean and likely very mean, the boxes swiveled slowly back and forth in a random fashion, locking onto every new face or profile for just a quick moment, then moving on when no threat was identified. Civilians and revolutionaries walked through here, and two rumpled figures were being questioned by the soldiers. The moment I stepped into the street, one of the boxes, maybe 30 meters away, picked up my movement and settled on my face. It was startling, and I reflexively stopped short. This must not have been a mundane movement sequence according to its defensive algorithms, because the thing stayed centered on me. Only two steps from the corner, but it might as well have been a light year. If this robot was programmed to fire upon fleeing suspects, I'd never make it. I'd read about similar semi-autonomous systems and knew that neither stopping short suddenly nor running away were good moves. But I hadn't seen anything like this on planet since arriving and had naturally been surprised. The thing would be analyzing my posture, body temperature, visible respiration, possibly my pulse even at this distance, and it was almost certainly gauging my fight or flight reaction. Even if it wasn't in aggressive mode, the auto gun might still flag me as someone the soldiers should stop and search. Though I doubt I stood there for longer than a couple of seconds, it seemed awkward and furtive even to me. Directly, I shuffled forward to the checkpoint and started making retching sounds. This, coupled with my shambling aspect, must have been a disgusting image, because the first soldier to spy me as I approached cursed and shook his head. He barked an order I couldn't follow, and gestured sharply that I was to pass around the checkpoint and keep walking. I waved to him in acknowledgement, then actually did throw up a little, because fake gagging always upsets my stomach for real. The soldier cursed even louder at this and shoved me by. Trippingly, I moved off to the left, my bags shouldered, an old Grano bottle of Mather's, filled with water, in my hand. Though everyone watched, no one saw. No one but the robot, which had focused on my erratic behavior despite the soldier clearing me through. Two or three times I cast a glance back over my shoulder, and it maintained a bead on my center mass until I was down the block and out of sight again. Where could these third-world jokers have possibly gotten weaponry like that? Suddenly, the commissioner's AIN conspiracy theory didn't seem so far-fetched. The Revolution was printing plastic rifles and handing them out to teenagers, yet they had access to high-end defensive robots? Such equipment had to be in limited supply. That would earmark them for high-priority missions, yet they were sitting in roadblocks. Maybe the checkpoint was a net for catching elites trying to sneak out of the city. That did seem to be important to these guys, but there would have had to be several such throughout town to be effective. Maybe, too, the auto guns were supposed to maintain order, since, as Mather's had predicted, there were many more civilians than I'd seen before, just walking around. At one point, I passed under the elevated tram line, and several of the cars went by overhead, jam-packed with people. DeLay Maharn's stated address was a few blocks away, in the more affluent part of town. There weren't any factories belching noxious fumes on this block, though there was a large machine shop. This had a clear, blast-resistant door in front that was shattered anyway, and a quick mob dashed in and out, looting tools and bars of metal stock, as well as what looked like emergency rations of all sorts in large cartons, which was a little weird. All this looting was within three blocks of that checkpoint, loaded with armed guards and robots, and this wasn't an isolated case. Doors into private residences and tiny boutiques alike had been jimmied and were now wide open. At least 200 people ran hither and thither, happily burdened by luxury. Grano, laughter, and quickly snatched items of nearly all descriptions floated around me like ghosts of the recent past. There were even several armed soldiers in the mix, weapons shouldered, excitement in their eyes and valuables in their arms, no different than the rest. At one point, several cold-geared figures dragged a battered and bloodied man out of an apartment building and threw him to the curb. Unlike the naked young buck from G's favorite cat house, this was an older guy, kind of fat and dressed in pajamas. He struggled in the dirty slush to get to his bare feet, as if to salvage a crumb of dignity, even in this circumstance. A young fellow who just happened to be passing by casually kicked him in the head, and the man just slumped back down. Everyone standing around this dangerous enemy elite was laughing, from the group that had pulled him from his slumber out into this waking nightmare to several looters nearby who'd stopped to enjoy the show. Maybe this guy was known and hated in the neighborhood. Maybe he wasn't. The kick was too hard for entertainment's sake, though, because he was out cold now. One of his captors just shook her head in disgust and fired five or six shots with her plastic weapon into the man's fat back. He jerked with each impact, but didn't otherwise react, except to die, of course. I kept walking. My appearance, much like the more desperate members of this frenetic mob of thieves and murderers, of these ordinary people, now empowered and drunk with the thought of long overdue justice. I was invisible. I was one of them, and grateful to be such, just as that dead guy in the street would have been had he been. How anyone could be caught napping now was a mystery, but people make big mistakes sometimes, and that would be his last. As I glanced at a grimy-looking family of five, laboring under the weight of an expensive sofa, slipping and laughing in the late afternoon ice and sludge, I allowed myself a moment of pure venom for this frozen, bloody, hateful planet. I savored an active dislike and distrust for all such wells, nicely terraformed or not, sparsely settled or not, peaceful and quiet or not. They were each a hell, and in those few seconds of self-indulgence, of well-earned petulance, I hated the vast majority of the human species simply because it lived in them. My map showed that I'd come to Maharn's apartment at last, so I did what I could to shake off the mood. It was a chic little apartment building, maybe 5 stories tall. According to the commissioner's information packet, her home was or had been on the 3rd floor. Like everything else in the neighborhood, it had seen the wrath of the common man. The windows facing the street were all broken or shot out, and the door at ground level was hanging open. Nice as the place had probably been, it seemed a little odd that a woman of such importance in the government lived here, instead of on some palatial estate out in the burbs the way her peers did. This could have been merely one of several abodes, therefore, but it was the only address I had. A small but pretty lobby met me as I stepped inside, even now still mostly untouched, though snow and trash had blown in. A couple of scruffy guys clomped down some stairs off to the right, large bags of loot in both hands. They spoke to me as they passed by as if I was an old friend, and I waved back. The elevator seemed to be functional because I could hear it moving when I pressed the button. I thought to save myself a climb, but it never came. I could hear people on the other floors as I walked up, and what sounded like an argument or a boisterous joke being told in a male voice on the 4th or 5th floor landing above me. The 3rd floor was quiet, though. Likely it had already been picked clean, but I stepped in cautiously anyway. There appeared to be only 5 apartments up here, and the doors to each had been kicked in. Trash, old clothes, and unidentifiable broken things littered the hallway. I saw big stains in the shag carpeting through 1 open door, but no bodies, thankfully. The address I was following led to the door on the end. This apartment overlooked the street. I self-debated the merits of assembling my rifle and having it ready, but most of the people in the streets carrying away booty seemed unarmed. Having no weapon in sight had saved me at the checkpoint. Well, that and the vomit. So it felt logical to proceed in the same way. Still in all, I kept my hand on the weapon's grip in the bag. The hallway's desolate character, coupled with the apparent distance now of the loud guys above, produced in me an unsettled feeling, like someone was waiting in ambush. The phantoms were only that, as it turned out. The apartment in question was just as quiet and unoccupied as all the rest, and just as picked over. I wouldn't go so far as to say that everything of value was now missing, but certainly everything easily portable was. Smashed glass and plastic objects were all over the place, and some real charmer had defecated right in the middle of the living room. Anything that could survive a 3-story fall had gone out that way, no doubt, and into the hands of excited and liquored-up cohorts in the street. A look out the window showed the process in action across the way, as a large chest of drawers was being lowered down from the 4th floor of an identical building by rope. This represented a degree of organization that was a cut above the random mob, maybe local gangs or black marketeers. At least business was booming for someone. There were a few media units still on the walls, but they were small, flat things, and very common, designed for personal vids or still images. One was folded over, with a big crease in the middle, having been better anchored than someone expected when they tried to tear it off the wall. It still worked, though, cycling through various warm, pastoral scenes, from a world that was definitely not this one. I looked for some sort of hidden safe behind the things, or a box or something that might have had some kind of clue about the woman who had, at least occasionally, made her home here. Considering that she'd hobnobbed with the rich and powerful, and, at least ostensibly, had been one of them herself, I figured there was an outside chance she might have secreted, well, something. But if so, it had either been carried off by the looters or by the owner herself sometime before. The bedroom was in a similar state as the rest of the place. Another broken media unit was in here on the wall, but the screen was only partially cracked, clear images of snowy fields and mountains cycling every few seconds. I stood there for several minutes, watching the highlights of a strange woman's life parade by, without ever seeing a repeat. These were all beautiful shots of Barlow. I recognized a few of the sights from tourist brochures I'd studied on the way in. A huge frozen harbor somewhere far from finery. A spectacular waterfall in the mountains, likewise frozen, and glinting a rainbow in the bright morning sun. A crowd of colorfully dressed Bastono participants flowing down a mountainside like a river. There were, in fact, a lot of still images and short, silent vid clips from good times up in the mountains. Several slid by from what appeared to be a single vacation. Most of these were of Maharn, and they were slick and smooth, indicating a small floating camera, probably a pocket-sized thing with integrated fans, which were popular with professionals and tourists alike. In several, she posed with a particular man, maybe in his 60s. The two of them usually stood atop a forested hill, snow all around, and a precious little valley below. Sometimes a large cabin could be seen in the background, complete with chimney and smoke. It looked almost like a ski lodge, though there were no skiers in view, nor anyone else but these two. It took 4 or 5 images and vid clips to cycle past before I finally recognized the man. Commissioner Vernays had called him General Bacon, leader of death squads, now dead. So that was the kind of company she kept. Based on the shining faces they bore in the images on this broken screen, they'd been a bit of an item, proving that even villains can have a romantic side. On a whim, I touched my wrist comp and queried the media device. It offered an unlocked interface, along with copy and download options, which meant nothing here was incriminating, nor even likely relevant. It would take time to study anyway, just to be sure. A boring, ordinary job I frankly looked forward to at this stage. An incoming call from Mathers flashed into my retinals just then. "Your friends are on the move," he said without preamble and on voice only. "There was a quick and dirty firefight at the Damo farm not less than an hour ago. It isn't on the RevNets yet, but a unit of the Blues dashed over to a storage facility out there and surprised a small contingent that failed to identify itself. You'll be shocked to learn your little news crew is armed and dangerous, assuming that was them. Sounded like them based on the description." "How'd it turn out? Any whispers?"
"Just one. A soldier on the ground, not content to wait for full disclosure from the new regime. Small and his team retreated. Got caught with their pants completely down, it seems, but they got away clean for all that. The revolution's glorious victors, I think that's what they're calling themselves today, consider this a serious win, though I don't know why just yet."
And Small...
"I'm online all the time. I'm a damn good. I'm a damn good. I'm a damn good. I'm a damn good. I'm a damn. I'm a damn. I'm a damn good cyber cheddar. And I hope you like my plan."
It was more diminutive than any useful cargo shuttle I'd ever heard of, though. There were other differences, too. The stealth suite, of course, but also port and starboard external pods, which suspiciously resembled fighter-style weapon bays. A bigger star jump array than I would have expected, implying an extended FTL range.
and a ramped-up sensor suite featuring what could only have been a military-class tracking dish in the bow. If they popped on their active sensors, we'd never be able to shake them. As pirates went, she was small, but she looked mean as a hornet. To give him his due, Bairn handled our Betchel like he was born to it. The man really had a talent, after all. We were approximately 85 kilometers ahead and 20 or so below the Macari, and we were matched in velocity. Our bow was facing them, and I took the liberty to return power to my targeting comps, which were tied into the sensor feed. If those pods held energy weapons, the attack would come before we even knew it, but missiles would give us a heads-up of about 20 seconds. I had a pretty good auto-firing program on a data cube I owned, something a real comp head I worked under several jobs before had written. I'd never had any need to use it, but it simmed well. I plugged it in now, debugged the interface, and let it run. The program could be set to fire at a specified time, or if the target brought up main drives, or really any trigger at all. I put in a short list of behaviors that would seem threatening under the circumstances, just to give us a little attack redundancy. If both Bairn and I failed to act, Dame Minnie would still get her two shots in. What can I say? I'm a sore loser. After an hour, it seemed likely that we hadn't been noticed. We held another meeting, just to make sure we all understood our jobs. We let Bairn give us a pep talk, which boosted his morale anyway, and then we got started. Sally and I suited up again and clipped into a couple of scoots. I carried the shape charges, while Sally brought along a bag with a variety of tools, and we each had a rifle secured carefully to the tops of our environmental packs. Extra ammo we carried in belt pouches. We had nearly 100 kilometers of open space to cross on those tiny scoots, which were only meant for bopping around the outside hull. They would be up to it, certainly, since we weren't going to be running under constant acceleration, but they sure weren't the height of luxury. Just a foldable tube frame that you buckled yourself into, with a small control pad on the front and a mini thruster system on the back that fed a series of hair-thin maneuvering nozzles sprinkled all over the thing. Scoots weren't fast or even especially safe, but they were agile. We'd reconnected comm for Guinness, who would be monitoring us all the way. We shifted to a channel he said wasn't likely to be monitored even by an auto system. It had our communications going back and forth over one rotating module while he piped real-time data to us from the boat's sensors on another. Then we waved to our shipmates, said goodbye to any plan B that might have been lurking around, stepped into the port airlock, and cycled. In 3 minutes, we were in open space.
Hey, what are the odds, Ejok, that they'll have proximity sensors or external cameras running?
Well, if they're really intent on ambushing Ponty, they probably won't have any actives running at all, even procs. You and I aren't noticeable enough in these suits to show up on passives until we're close, and we'll be coming up on their aft, directly through a thruster exhaust trail, so we might not register at all. As for cameras, well, they're usually just used for docking purposes. Pretty much only the pilot on duty during berthing sequences ever looks at them, and then only to make sure the ship is coming in straight. No one would be watching now.
You have no idea, in other words.
Not a one.
You're a sphincter, Ejok.
Okay, I guess so, but I'm also right.
How do you know? How do you know you're right? How many times have you done this before? Wait, I'll tell you. Zero. Nobody's ever done this before. You know why? Because it can't be done.
If you want my opinion.
I already know your opinion, Guinness. Let us work this out. Feel better?
Yeah, I think so. This is beyond crazy, Ejok.
We're still right outside the boat, Sally. I can open the lock again. You call it.
Oh, now it's my decision. It's your maternal mating plan. Are you saying it won't work now?
No, I still think it'll work, but not if you aren't committed to it. I need you, Sal. I need everyone. And Ponty needs us. For crying out loud, we're just a bunch of losers. We're in a remote corner of a bleak system in a broken-down boat, and not one of us is getting paid what we're worth. But Ponty's going to get hit if we don't do something. We're losers, but we have a job to do. Whether or not Dame Minnie is up to the challenge, we have to be. This might not work. Okay, it probably won't work. But I wouldn't be able to look at myself in the mirror if I sat on the sidelines now.
We signed up to fight off pirates. If we're not going to do our jobs, then why do we even have them? Why did we even apply?
Because we all needed the work, Ejak. But we don't need to die.
Dying is sometimes part of our work. Okay, it's corny, but we put ourselves in harm's way for a living. If you wanted it safe, you'd have moved planetside somewhere long ago, doing whatever, fixing air cars or waiting tables. We all would have. We're spacers. We've all had a lot of births. Well, today, we fight pirates and we save ships. Maybe not our own, but that's our job.
You really believe that, don't you? You have a soldier complex, Ejak. You want to be a fragging hero, and you want us to go along for the ride.
We went all over this. Why are we having this conversation now, Sally?
Because I'm floating in deep space on a scoot. Because I'm not a fleet marine, but I'm part of an attack team. Because that attack team consists of just 2 people. Because I very much believe I'm going to die a very violent death very soon.
The fact that no one would ever try this is exactly why it can work. If you're really not up to it, Sally, tell me now, before we get someplace where I'll need to rely on you.
Now that's not fair, Ejak. None of us signed up for this, including you. Everything we're doing here is purely optional. Considering the circumstances, nobody would ever ask us why we didn't try to take that bogey down.
I would ask. Every day of my life, I would ask why. Why I turned and ran. Why I didn't want to do my job. Why Ponte was dead. You're wrong, Sally. I don't want to be a hero. I just want to sleep at night.
So, what's it going to be, folks?
I guess we're coming back in.
No, we're going on.
Are you sure, Sally? You know this is crazy. There's no way the two of you could possibly...
I'm well aware of what we're doing here, Guinness. We're going to take this thing down.
Sally, you... Why?
Just keep this channel open and the chatter down, okay?
Yes. Yes, okay.
Thanks, Sally.
You too, Ejak. Let's just do this.
In 10 minutes, we picked it up on suit light amps, a bulky shape seen from behind, with 3 main engine nozzles and a spidery jump array spanning out like gossamer. The pods stretched out angrily to either side, and the mysterious little vessel mounted on top was just as mysterious from even this proximity. We both keyed our suit cams, now that there was something to see, and I zoomed in on the piggybacker.
You getting this, Guinness?
Yeah. That auxiliary boat there. Any ideas?
I was hoping you'd seen one before.
No, sorry, I... What? Hold on a second. Bairn says that's an automated probe. A mining probe, maybe, or science. He says he's hauled them for the company prospectors before, but that this one looks modified.
Modified how? Put them on.
Captain Bairn here.
No stool, you muttonhead.
Sally, please. How is this thing different, Bairn? What do you think these guys use it for?
Well, the RM tank is missing for one. No reaction mass, no mobility. It's a waste of hardware.
Anything else?
Not that I can see. Wait, could you beef up your contrast, both of you? More. Yes. Good. Now... Ejak, zoom into that box on the back of the probe. No, the small one. A little closer. Okay, yes. Aha!
What is it? What's it for?
Oh, I don't know.
Why do you even open your mouth?
Sally! Could it be an explosive of some kind?
A bomb? Oh, I doubt it. No one would buy a probe like this just to blow it up. They're too expensive. Even the cheap ones. Missiles cost a fraction of the price, and they're much faster than any probe. And I don't think this one can move at all.
Would the AI be active right now?
Well, when they ship them out from the factory, they're not activated. They don't even have Prime Functions software installed. That's a separate purchase, and it's up to the buyer to program the thing however it's needed.
Sally, what do you think?
You can't just turn an AI on and off whenever you want. They fail out fast like that. By the same token, once they're on, they're dangerous to leave sitting idle. They can get it into their brains to implement their programming at really inconvenient times. If I were these guys, I'd put it into some kind of non-repeating simulation mode. That way, it could keep busy doing what it wants to do without causing any trouble. You could store it like so much baggage, and yet you could use it at a moment's notice.
It wouldn't be running its own sensors then, or be getting a live feed from the ship?
In the scenario I just described, no. But I might be wrong, Ijuk. I'm probably wrong. There's too many variables here, too much we don't know.
Let's assume you're right. Would it be able to detect us if we started messing with it? If we succeed in disabling this ship, this probe might still try something. I don't know what that could be, but I don't want to find out the hard way.
Bayern, does this thing look like a Shinjozo smart drone to you? I've read about them, but I've never seen one.
I've never heard of a Sandrino smart Jozo, or whatever you said. I transported Gratchen K's, Storin's, and GP's. This is a GP.
You're sure?
Yes.
You're really sure?
Yes, I am.
You're really, really sure?
Sally!
All right, Ijuk, I just hate trusting him. I've never worked with autonomous probes. If he is right, then we should be able to do some limited tinkering without rousing it. We could probably place one of your charges on it if that's what you've got in mind.
No, I don't have one to spare. I'm just so tempted to take a hammer to this thing.
That's an unwise action.
Sally's right, Ijuk.
I knew she was, but I at least wanted a closer look at the thing. I gave my scoot a puff of acceleration. I couldn't see Sally behind me, but I heard her curse quietly, which I figured she'd only do if she'd decided to follow. I eased over the aft end of the pirate and jetted slowly to the probe, which was anchored there by four large clamps.
Where's the AI located on this thing?
Probably deep inside, in a reinforced casing.
So counter-programming is out, since I see no external ports, and we could fight for years trying to crack it wirelessly. Okay, let's make this easy. Bairn, you say this thing couldn't fly whether it was clamped down or not. Sally, do you concur?
She scooted around slowly, studying it, then simply said yes.
All right. Genis, any changes, any sign they've noticed us yet?
Nope. It's like they're dead. I really hate this whole predator-prey thing.
You and me both. All right. We don't know why the probe is here. We don't even know if it works. Let's just forget about it for now. Eyes open, though.
I helped Sally maneuver back around the probe with an extra hand, which in turn set me to wobbling. I had to drift out a bit to get the room to stabilize, and then I scooted over to the starboard weapon pod. It was an irregular mass of metal and plastic points and cables, 2 meters across, extending out maybe 10 meters on a tapering triangular spar. A forward-facing missile five-pack and a stubby particle beam stood out sharply in the light amp of the suit's optics. The missiles were an unknown quality until they were used, but the P-beam was a pretty common civilian type I'd studied and simmed before. It was strictly a close-range item. Dame Minnie could be hurt by it where she was parked, maybe, but Ponty would be safe until it got much closer. I took out one of the dinner plate-sized shape charges from the box I was carrying, peeled off the plastic sheet from its adhesive backing, and stuck it onto the spar. That was one down. Sally came floating up into my view.
Want me to put one on the other side?
Have you ever set a charge before?
No.
It's not so easy.
Really? You peeled it off and stuck it on. What'd I miss?
I handed her a charge. She scooted over the dorsal ridge of the ship while I dropped under and towards the back. I found a sealed hood that looked like a main drive access panel. Trying to open that would kick on their automated anti-intruder systems for sure, which we didn't want to do until we were ready. I figured, though, that it was a reasonable assumption that a maintenance hatch would be located in a spot where maintenance was needed. This close to the main drives, that meant a juncture of some sort in the piping for the fuel, likely one that held a pump. It was as good a spot as any. My last charge went there, right over the seam of the hood and the hull, where the extra armor would be weakest.
Sally, do you think that bump thing up front is the bridge?
Well, it's either that or a fueling dock.
Fueling dock?
Yeah, they use them in the Papal Territories. They have a union or guild or something that does nothing but refuel ships. They do it manually, Most boats and ships built over there have a dock installed just for that. Makes the mass transfer go smoothly or something. That looks like one of those, but these guys are a long way from home if that's the case.
Aren't we all?
Status again?
No change, E-Jock. I'll let you know.
Okay. Sally, if that is a fueling dock, then there has to be a valve or something over there, right?
Yeah, that and manual controls for the onboard fuel transfer pump.
Manual? As in hand-thrown on-off switches? That's idiotic. Are you sure?
Who am I? Bairn? Yes, I'm sure.
Come on, I'm right here.
Sal, you mean to say that there's a way to physically access the fuel line from out here?
Maybe. The guildies over there don't let anything become an automated process if it might take control away from their little monopolies. At least, I've seen manual valve controls on their ships before. Let's take a look.
So we did. Sure enough, we found a small access panel on the bump in the armor, which Sally stated for sure was a fueling station. I wondered aloud if high temperatures right there could do anything for us.
No, there are safeguards against fires and explosions during refueling. You wouldn't ignite the fuel tank, and there's no oxygen anyway.
I'm thinking more along the lines of simulating a fire so as to trigger a fire suppressant sequence in their systems. That would lock them up tight for a bit. It could be a good distraction for getting inside. If they don't have weapons running hot already, that could make a big difference for us. I mean, we're in agreement here, right? These guys aren't legit.
No, they're crooked, all right. I just don't see how you think we can get inside fast enough to surprise them. We could cut through a hatch pretty quickly and gain access to an airlock, but we couldn't use it to enter without depressurizing the ship, which of course will cause an emergency lockdown and... Okay, I get it now.
Get what? Yes, what is it?
If you open up a ship to hard vacuum, it closes off all emergency iris valves and pressure hatches inside, effectively cutting off the crew from us and each other. That can be overridden easily by the captain, though. Not so with fire suppressant sequences. Those require a series of system checks before they can be overridden. Layer the two, and they'll be wasting a lot of time just figuring out what's going on. Meanwhile, you guys call them and tell them to stand down. If they're surprised, which we're counting on, they'll lose even more time. And while they do that, we cut through to the next section, hopefully a central corridor, which will prevent any override to the lockdown, since the comp won't allow anybody to open a hatch onto VAC without inputting a suit's clearance code first.
They might be in suits already, or have them near.
If we were trying this closer to Ponty's interception time, I'd agree with you, since an experienced crew going into a potential battle would take those kinds of precautions. But these guys won't have them handy yet, I'm thinking. The suits will be in stowage somewhere, as isolated from the crew as the crew will be from the rest of the ship, and maybe each other.
But how do we take the ship, then? They won't be able to open the doors to the bridge or engineering, even if they want to.
We can do temporary patches on all the holes we make if it looks like we're getting somewhere with them, but we won't repressurize right away. Their internal sensors will register that they still have an air loss that way, and we can negotiate a surrender. If they think a bunch of us have gotten inside, they'll have to give it up.
And what happens when they learn it's only the two of us?
We'll have them disarmed and locked up by then, hopefully. It's mostly bluff. Just act mean, Sally.
That won't be hard.
Their internal sensors, cameras or whatever, will show that it's just the two of us. You can't bluff when they know what cards you're holding.
Okay, then we say that the rest of our people are still outside. Doesn't make any sense, I know, but they'll be upset and maybe not thinking logically. They'll be checking sensors and looking to confirm what we're saying. It's a timing thing. We work fast, act tough, and we lie through our teeth. By the time they realize that we're full of crap, we'll have them. Think it'll work?
Not a prayer. Let's get started.
Sally brought an oxy torch out and got ready to go at the fuel intake. I fetched a plasma torch from her bag and scooted over to the side hatch, which was a standard-looking personnel lock for vessels of this size. We 1-2-3'd it, then started cutting. I really wasn't sure what Sally had in mind for the fuel duct, but she at least acted like she knew what she was doing, which more or less made me believe that she did. I cut through the locking mechanism for the external hatch, knowing sensors were probably tripping like crazy inside there. I imagined a crew of desperados scrambling now for vac suits, weapons, sensors, etc., and I worked faster than ever.
Pop on actives, Genis, if you have the power. Tell me what's happening.
I'm on it.
and call them on standard channels and order a stand down. We're going in.
Cutting through a Pollinium door mechanism doesn't take long if you know where to put the hole. I was done in less than a minute and had the lock itself exposed. A twist here and a spin there with a ZG ratchet and the heavy door popped open, easy as you please.
Sally, I'm in. You ready?
Yeah, their heat sensors will be registering a fireball at the intake valve. They're closing up in there right now. Feel those vibrations? Emergency lockdowns in progress. Hatches and valves shutting. Everything. It's working!
Not surprisingly, I couldn't feel anything, so I took her word for this too.
Genis, what's the word? They panicky yet?
Hold on.
There's no time, Gen. What are they saying?
I'm not sure. I'm getting something weird here.
Patch us in.
Full sensors engaged. One contact registered. They just hit actives, people. We're in the spotlight now.
Sally, stay clear. I'm blowing the weapon pods.
Hold it. I'm still exposed.
She cruised down from dorsal and grabbed at a handhold near me.
Okay, I'm clear.
Firing in 5 standard seconds.
Blow them.
I tripped my suit comp. There was a yellow flash on our side of the ship, and then nothing more.
All weapons offline.
The one pod we could see from our POV cartwheeled off into the darkness and was invisible almost immediately. The calm, strangely resonant voice continued without pause. No hint of surprise evident whatsoever.
That's a machine, Ejok. They have the AI in charge of this thing.
I'll admit, I was at a complete loss for a minute there.
Where the hell are the people? This thing didn't jump in on its own, did it?
Maybe they're letting the AI handle things while they get ready?
Standing by.
Come on, would you do that? I wouldn't. When there's a crisis, you man your post. Even pirates would do that much. Genis, are you getting any chatter whatsoever?
Not a bit. Even the AI is quiet now.
They completely slaved the ship to the probe, Ejok.
Then why not just install an AI on the ship's own computer? This doesn't make any sense at all.
Not unless they need to remove the AI quickly and easily at some point. That thing is clamped down back there, not welded. Sever the data lines, take a power wrench to the mount, and it's off. I could do it in an hour if I had to.
Maybe you should, Sally.
No, she shouldn't. Not if the AI is seeing us as hostiles right now. Remember, those things have sensors of their own, and maybe self-preservation coding, too. We took out the weapons, but there could be other surprises. We mess with the probe itself, and it might activate engines or go to star jump. Hell, with a hard burn on thrusters, it could do a fast axial pitch change and just smack us into the black.
Well, there's no reaction mass on the probe itself. For whatever reason, they must have intended it to do its job out there.
Yeah, and that box on its back. Not a bomb, but a bypass or circuit shunt or something. Come on, Sally. Let's go in and do a search.
We tethered the scoots near the open airlock and proceeded to the inner door, which we opened in the same manner as the other one. A fast, almost explosive rush of crystallizing atmosphere buzzed out for a few seconds as soon as a hole had been made. To the unfamiliar, cutting through locked doors on space vessels might seem like it should be hard to do. Normally, that would be true, but people like Sally, and to a lesser degree myself, assembled, installed, and repaired those things for a living. Other than a few aftermarket lockout doohickeys, which were designed to curb break-ins when the ship was docked, there wasn't anything unusual here to slow us down. Under normal docking or spaceport circumstances, a klaxon and computer alert to the yokel badges would eat up all the time it would reasonably take to do the work, long, dirty, cutting work without the right tools. In fact, this ship had easier doors to open than even our crummy Betchel did, and that wasn't uncommon. My so-called plan had counted on this, though it was beginning to look like a lot of worry for nothing. We unslung our rifles anyway and had them ready.
Hatch open.
No lights on. Amplification isn't worth much in here. Switching on suit floods. How much of this are you guys getting?
Looks good. Is this a central companionway? Are those hatches on the sides?
No, we're in a connecting corridor. Looks like it right angles with the ship's core. Got another door to go through on the far end. Artificial gravity is off. Typical anti-hijack protocol. These narrow hatches on the sides look like stowage lockers, and yeah, they're locked, but they're not pressure capable. Not big enough for somebody in a suit to hide in either. Moving on.
The internal door proved to be even easier to open, taking 30 seconds to crack. Another sparkling hiss of escaping atmosphere preceded our swinging it open, this time lasting a minute or so, after which we were greeted by more blackness. A few tiny unit lights of varying colors peeped and blinked here and there along the walls on various switches and controls, but nothing more. Floods revealed a wide corridor that looked like it had been either designed for or converted to rec room use. Things were packed neatly away. Game sticks and smack balls in convenient racks on one bulkhead, a dark, mute entertainment center mounted along the other. Cushioned seats that locked in place on floor tracks sat off to the sides, leaving the central way clear.
Compulsive neat freaks?
Yeah, it's awfully clean in here for a sudden emergency lockdown. But why would they send this thing into jump empty? What good's a pirate ship without any pirates?
The ship's logo was on the wall near what looked like a beverage dispenser.
Gen, look this up in the ship registry. It's not in English. What is that? Latin?
Low speak. It says DAFKA. That means preparedness or state of readiness.
You can speak another language?
Some. You guys aren't from around here. Diegman gets a lot of traffic from over the border. We have to deal with guildies all the time.
I caught a glimpse of Sally's expression through her helmet, and she seemed amazed and maybe just a little impressed.
Okay, I've got a DAFKA listed here as... ship type just says it's a far trader. It looks like, it says it was built by the most honorable spatial mercantile collective of the beneficent Tyrandua state of Rikertov within Far Reach, and it goes on and on. Just a shipyard and church space. It was built for a noble shipping family, in service for 10 years. Looks like it changed hands 2 more times. Pretty typical overall. It's currently owned by an investment consortium in the corporate territories.
When was that listing updated? Legit corporations don't go in for piracy, too much liability. This thing must be stolen.
No, it's current. Last update was 74 hours ago. Just before our little problems started.
Well, still.
Ejok, the mods on this ship would have taken weeks at a shipyard, or even longer if they did it on the sly. And they're expensive, too. No regular pirate outfit could afford it. If that listing's up to date, then this thing, as is, belongs to that company.
Oh, man, then it's corporate trouble. That's all we need. Let's do a fast sweep here, Sal, then check engineering for something we can use on Dame Minnie. I don't want to be here now even more than I didn't want to be here before.
A quick look around revealed a ship perfectly packed up as if awaiting its first crew. Cabins deserted and spotless, not a soul anywhere. Cargo revealed several standard freeze tubes, but they were empty too. We didn't have time to try to crack the ship's computer, and anyway, military-grade decryption was usually required for that sort of thing, as opposed to outmoded second-hand civilian-class gunboat decryption, initiated by no one with any expertise in the matter.
Okay, that's everywhere. We're alone in here. Bairn, bring Dame Minnie over. Park as close as you can.
That'll be it for the engines, then. There won't be enough power to fire up after that.
Doesn't matter. We have nowhere else to go. I'm counting on a miracle on this end, so just get her close.
Engineering was significantly cleaner and more spacious than on Dame Minnie, and Sally, locating their battery bank, floated over and opened the tidy case.
Wow! Oh, wow! Skarcher Nova Ceram Packs! Fully charged yet, see? They each have their own full diag panel. Oh, man, this is sweet!
Are these standard on a ship like this?
These aren't standard anywhere. These are the latest thing. I read about them only a month ago. We could run Dame Minnie all the way back to Diegman on only 2 of these, with normal gravity for the whole trip and juice left over for a party.
They're a lot bigger than our power cells. Heavier, too, I'll bet.
Not in ZG, they aren't. Just gotta watch the mass when we're moving them around. They can be programmed for just about any power and waveform output up to their max, so I wouldn't even need to jury-rig a converter. We just have to get them over there, strap them down somewhere, and we're back in the saddle.
They're expensive, I take it.
Oh, Mama, yes. They're marketed to elite corporate security, ritzy private yacht owners, intelligence organizations. You know, customers with deep pockets.
How are they going to fit out the side airlock?
What are you talking... Yeah, all right. The side airlock's too small for these. We'll just have to use the cargo doors.
Aren't those on the bottom?
Yeah, what of it?
How do you get them down there? I didn't see anything like a floor hatch or big elevator in your video feed. Just that little spiral staircase.
Well, they got the copulating things in here somehow.
They might have removed the whole airlock frame from the side of the ship during the big refit. That's SOP in shipyards, isn't it?
You mean we found the perfect power solution, but we can't get them out of here? I'm not ready to give up yet, E-Juck.
Neither am I, Sally. We have to get these things. The question is, how?
Okay, we're outside now. 10 meters off starboard and holding. And I had a thought. Can't you just cut a hole in the side of the ship and bring them out that way?
With what, you asshole? You think we brought a whole shipyard of equipment with us out here? Cutting a few centimeters off an airlock isn't like chopping a 2-meter-wide hole through armored hull casing.
Wait. We're set up for it already.
What are you talking... Oh, don't tell me, Ejuk. They'll be wrecked.
No, look, Sally, see? The jump engines are in the way. They'll act as cover, I think.
Doesn't look that way to me. Where's the ejector point on this side?
Probably right there, along that bulkhead.
How can you be so sure?
Well, that's the main fuel conduit, right? And there's the branch point for it, and that's the primary fuel pump for the line, so that's got to be the spot.
What are you two plotting? Clue in your loyal crewmates, Bray.
We're going to blow a hole through the bulkhead, right here in engineering.
Fabulous! Good idea, people.
Oh, Ejuck.
We could reset it in here, then the blast would be mostly carried outside.
That'd be true if we didn't have those feed lines right there. Those are real high pressure, right? I'm thinking they could actually turn enough of the blast away that it might not cut through the hull. Blow it from the other side, and we're gold.
Then what about a hole somewhere else where the feeds won't be an issue? If the batteries get damaged, we're out of luck.
Okay. Yeah, good point. Let's look for a spot out in the main corridor.
Guys, you might want to hear this. It's the AI.
Approaching at 0.472 gravities, mark constant acceleration. Spectral analysis of heat trail complete.
Where's it coming from, Gen?
I don't know. Nothing on scans yet. Wait. Oh, no. It's Ponty.
What? Get them on the horn. Tell them to abort.
It's offline, remember?
Hook it back up.
7B. Installed warhead. Motherlode. Mark 7. Tactical nuclear defensive device. Yield rating. 0.35.
Okay, that's part two, Don. One more to go. I'd love to hear what you think of Motherlode, good or bad. I can't get better until I know what I need to improve, right? I have all my contact information in the closing credits, so just keep listening for that. Also, remember that the plain text version of this story is available for free at my site, while a Kindle version is available at Amazon.com for a small fee, a pittance, chicken feet. You can find links for all that on CavalcadeAudio.com, which is my home for the various projects I'm pursuing. This will include full-blown audio dramas, I have a few there already, audiobooks, novels, at least one children's book, which I have in mind, and some other things too embryonic yet to speak of. But soon. If you like this story, please tell a friend. If you don't, please tell them anyway. They might like it. Either way... And as always, I thank you for listening. Take care.
The perfect match.
Next time on Motherlode.
15 seconds.
Kill me and you'll never find all the recorders no matter how hard you try. That's a guarantee.
6 of these batteries are garbage now.
10.
Ponty's trying to kill us, or she doesn't care if we die. Either way, she's poison.
Bring it up, Baron. Up.
Come on, Captain Crunch. Axial spin. Yaw.
5.
Get me. Sally, catch me. Now, Baron. Full on.
Impact.
You have been listening to the Cavalcade Audio Productions presentation of Motherlode, Book 1 of Star Drifter, written and read by Lost in Bronx. You can contact me at lostinbronx@gmail.com. That's LOSTNBRONX@gmail. You can find Cavalcade Audio Productions on Google+ and on Facebook. And I'm on Twitter and Identica as Lost in Bronx. Drop me a line and tell me what you think. And please do check out my site, cavalcadeaudio.com, where you can read the complete text version of this story, check out the credits and attributions for the show, sign up for the feed, and stay current with everything that's going on. Motherlode is a work of fiction and is not meant to portray any person living or dead, nor any particular place or situation. Apparent similarities are purely coincidental. The Star Drifter theme is a piece called Trunks Icor, released by Royal Bass Records, and is available on SoundCloud.com. The music for Motherlode is called Love Me or Not by DubFX and is used under special permission. It can be found at convoyunlimited.bigcartel.com. These artists retain their respective licenses for their content. This production is otherwise copyright 2012 by David Collins Rivera and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Sharealike Unported 3.0 license. Feel free to use it for any purpose, even commercial, and I encourage you to do so. Respect the license, respect the fans, share and share alike. Talk to you soon.
So, that was part two, leaving you on a bit of a cliffhanger. Sorry about that, but that's how you get people to come back, hopefully. So, as I've stated before, Motherlode is a three-part story, so next week will be the last part. And after that, I don't know, I might do a Star Drifter short story. I might begin the next book, which is something that I don't think I wrote a short story between those two, so I may as well just do it that way and then inject the short stories, you know, after that, because that's when I started really writing them. At any rate, I hope you're enjoying it, and if not, well, you know, as I say, it's not going to be for everybody. It's not going to be everybody's cup of tea, but if you don't mind something a little different on a non-radio, then maybe it might be something that you or someone you know might really enjoy, if you want to clue them in. At any rate, if you like it and you gotta have more right now, you can go to davidcollinsrivera.com, and that's got everything. That's all Star Drifter stuff. That's every, you know, you can find pretty much everything I'm doing over there, or links to stuff that I'm doing. And as I've stated before, I think that I'm probably going to do other stuff as well as Star Drifter. I have a series of drama and humorous stories set in a mythical town in the Southwest, and other things like that. So, you know, I have stuff. At any rate, I guess I'll leave it off here for this week, and I want to thank you again for listening in. So take care.